Hi, this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition. Who will be the lead singer? When are you going to ship this app that you've been talking about for so long that we've been alluding to and which apparently you are planning to actually share with the world one of these days?
So you and our listeners will be surprised, but I have shipped it.
What?
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. There was a period of time there where I thought that it was going to be this sort of infinite 1.0 development cycle where it would absolutely never ship. But I did. So it's out there. It has been released. People that like it are buying it. And I'm hearing feedback from people and starting to get a couple reviews in. And it's there, finally.
Congratulations. it sounds like all you need to do now is figure out how to make people who don't like it also buy it.
Right. Yeah. Before they realize that they don't like it or after.
I don't care.
Either one. Yeah. As long as I get the money. Now, it's going well. It's interesting because it's sort of a soft launch, I guess you could say. I didn't actually send out any press releases. I didn't even blog about it until the next week. But I was really lucky to have a couple people pick up on it and getting feedback. And
you're a very sneaky, sneaky man, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of in this for the long haul. This app, I'm happy with the way 1.0 shaped up. But at the same time, there are so many things that it still needs and that, you know, that I'm going to build on with 1.1 and 1.2. And so I felt like the right thing was to ship it finally, but kind of go a little bit slow. And then my plan is, after 30 days after launch, I'm going to have a 1.1, and that's when I'm going to kind of put the big PR push behind it and letting more bloggers and reviewers know about it and starting to promote it more. But so far, so good. I mean, I'm happy with it. The kind of question I had early on was, so I have my other independent product, WeTransfer, and it sells pretty well, even though it doesn't quite get the attention that it deserves. And I was wondering, was that a fluke or is that kind of normal for how Mac software should sell? And that was kind of one of the questions I had going into this. And so far, so good.
All right.
The new app is called ClipStart, by the way. For people who haven't seen it, you know, it's for movie management and tagging and uploading to Flickr and Vimeo. And I don't know, people seem to like it. I think people see the potential of it and what problem it solves that no other app is really focused on right now.
That's great. Sounds like it's a good, successful 1.0, and we'll just have to wait and see if you get that that worrisome 1.1 drop off of press attention and all that, right?
Yeah, and I'm hoping the opposite happens. If I don't actually get a lot more press for 1.1, then I think I've done something wrong. Because although I consider the 1.0 a success, it is not an amazing success. I mean, there were several days, even right after I launched it. And by launch, I mean, you know, upload it to the server. Like I said, I haven't really promoted it much, where WeTransfer was outselling it even right after it launched.
Okay.
So it was not an overnight success. And if 1.1 doesn't bump it up a little bit, that would be a little bit disappointing.
Yeah. Well, that's a good start. It must be a real relief to you to have the 1.0 out of the way. And I always love it when you can take something from when it's pre 1.0, you don't even have like the last version to share with people. So it's kind of like all this work you've put into it is a private celebration until you get that 1.0 out there.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. Yeah. So, you know, I wish I could say I have a 1.0 product to announce to the world, but I'm in a kind of a similar development cycle right now because I spent the past month or so really trying to crank on an iPhone app that I'm developing, which will not see the light of day for some time, but which I needed to finish sufficiently in order to submit it to the Apple Design Awards. There's a special category this year for iPhone 3.0 compatible applications. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a perfect category for me because my app's not done, and that's a requirement actually of the category. It cannot be a shipping application. So I thought I'd use that as a kind of a motivator to crank away at this application I've been working on. it's very true what they say about, you know, deadline being a motivator can really, you know, force you to crank through those otherwise lazy days. I would just have to sit down and say, no, I don't have much time. I have 30 days. I gave myself a rule, which was, aside from support emails and stuff like that, I was not allowed to really work on other applications, coding and research and development. So every day it was kind of interesting getting up and saying, what can I do to move myself closer to this submittable application?
Yeah.
It's done, submitted. Kind of an interesting just wait and see situation now. I don't have great hopes of winning or anything, but it's really one of those situations where just the deadline and the motivator for getting it done is in its own way kind of a victory. So,
well, and you still have, you know, we don't know exactly when 3.0 is going to ship, I guess. So you still have a lot of time to actually wrap up the app for real customers.
Right. Yeah.
I think in some ways the deadline is really helpful. And usually before the Apple Design Awards, we see, you know, people are kind of working on their apps to the last minute. And then like the week before the deadline, you see all these new apps ship. Didn't really see that this time. I don't feel like there was only a couple apps.
Well, yeah, like our friend Chris Licio, mm-hmm. he released his Capo app, which is pretty cool. It's for those of you in the audience who haven't heard of it, it's for musicians who want to slow down music. It's kind of like this other product that's been around for years called the Amazing Slowdowner. Chris's take on it is like it has to be attractive, simple to use, and it's really a nice improvement on that idea, I think.
Yeah, that's a great looking app.
Definitely timed for and well suited for an Apple Design Award mm-hmm. submission. So
yeah, and that's a good example of, because you never know exactly what Apple's looking for. I mean, they have sort of a bullet list of things you should do, but not all apps, I think, fit, you know, the kind of app that is going to win. I mean, like you said, you know, your chances are slim or whatever. And I think just some apps, they don't fit kind of what Apple's looking for, that make a great demo.
Right.
You know, that have all this sort of glitzy, shiny UI.
Another thing that was submitted this year around the right time to be kind of conspicuously aimed at the Design Awards was Espresso, right? Wasn't that?
Right, that's true.
Pretty recently. And
yeah, and that was only at least a few weeks maybe before.
And Coda last year, similar app, won one of the categories, I think.
Yep.
And so maybe Espresso is hoping that this is its year mm-hmm. this time around.
Yeah, I came up with a list. I think I posted on Twitter of a few apps that I could remember. Espresso was one. Little Snapper was another that seemed, it was released earlier, but it seemed to sort of have the qualities that Apple maybe was looking for. Things, actually, I think could be a contender, because that was fine. I mean, it's been in public beta for a long time, but I think it was only released this year.
Yeah, I guess it's a bigger pool than we might have guessed.
So I released Clipstart literally just a few days before the Design Awards deadline, and it was just coincidence. I wanted to ship it. I had no intention of submitting it. In the end, I did decide to submit it because, hey, it doesn't hurt. But before I submitted it, I was thinking, God, if I'd only done this one extra feature, maybe, or if I'd only done this one thing. And at first I almost, so it was maybe like 4 or 5 days after I released it was the deadline. I almost pushed the 1.01 out early just so that there would be a couple extra fixes and tweaks. And then I stopped myself and I said, you know, as much as the deadlines help motivate you to get it out, I think it's wrong to sort of artificially ship something early or artificially like add a bunch of features that don't belong there just in the hope that, oh, Apple is going to like this new thing that I added. That could be great. It could work out great, or it could backfire in that you push something out too early and with the wrong things that maybe customers don't actually need.
Yeah.
And then you make some mistake and introduce a bug or.
It is an interesting balancing act, and I think there is an obvious kind of distaste and just sort of fortifying an application with, you know, in a way Apple encourages this because they publish the judging guidelines for the contest, and mm-hmm. so it's easy for developers to go down the list and say, oh, I'm not going to be judged well on that front, so maybe I should do something. But it is kind of like, well, if you know, if you just like gratuitously add some animation or something to an otherwise useful application.
Yeah.
You know, fortunately, I don't think gratuitous apps have been winning that I've been noticing. I mean, like Coda last year seemed like a reasonable candidate for the for the prize.
Yeah, definitely.
But you know, this year, actually going back to the fact that I did submit something, I thought about that problem, and I have to admit that I was not planning on using Core Data on the iPhone for my persistence model. I was just going to do something pretty simple with kind of the dictionaries, storing plists or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it came down to the point where I hadn't implemented it yet, and it was going to be just about, I think, as easy to go one way or the other. So I went with the Core Data because it was actually my first experience really working with Core Data. And yeah, I have to admit it was pretty easy, and provided it works well, it got this other bullet point on my application for suitability for that particular category. So it was kind of like, why am I doing this? Well, it's true, it's colored by this desire to meet a certain standard, but on the other hand, I also, you know, finally got out of my cave and used this technology, which I think for me and for a lot of other developers who have applications whose lifetimes precede Core Data and other technologies, it's really easy to sort of just put off using them and keep using the old style trusted, you know, kind of you control everything methods.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try to break out of that a little bit. You know, every once in a while I sort of chuckle and relish the fact that I'm not using so much of these newer technologies, particularly when, you know, people are banging their heads about weird little bugs that they can't seem to track down. But
yeah,
it seems to work. And one of the nice things about the iPhone is I think the metaphorical test matrix for any particular product is a little bit simpler because there's a lot fewer inputs and outputs, you know, like you can't drag a random document from some other application into your iPhone app. And, you know, the sort of fuzzing possibilities for an application are, I think, a lot more limited on most iPhone apps. So kind of a nice thing about the iPhone is, to a large extent, I feel like you can exercise an app and be a little bit more certain that it's going to work within those parameters for other people.
Yeah, that's a great point. So as we record this, WWDC is coming up soon, actually, just a few weeks from now.
Yeah.
Apple just put out a little press release, I think a couple of days ago, saying no Steve Jobs at the keynote. I think a lot of people were hoping he would make a surprise visit, and maybe he still will.
Yeah.
But he definitely won't be the main speaker. How do you feel about that?
As a stockholder, I think it is one of these petty little things that, unfortunately, I think it does affect the stock price to some extent. And so I would be excited to have a sort of a triumphant Steve Jobs appearance sooner than later.
Yeah.
And I know John Gruber on Daring Fireball, he speculated that, he said something like his gut feeling is that Steve Jobs's days of keynote presentations are over.
Mm-hmm.
And they clarified he does think that Steve is coming back, but he just thinks sort of this was the segue to a less, you know, public role for Steve.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's no getting around the fact that if that's true, that's a loss for Apple, even if he continues to be managerial, you know, guiding light for the company. It's become a part of the hype culture for Apple with the press. The press cares more about Apple's events because Steve Jobs is part of that sort of theater, you know? And I just don't think anybody else at Apple right now has the same kind of draw. So it's like, you know, if you've got a famous rock band, you know, it's important that the guitarist and the drummer and, you know, the bassist are all really expert and awesome and they shred, but if the lead singer doesn't show up, then you don't really have the same experience and you're not really going to sell the same number of tickets, and the same number of people aren't going to talk about it to their friends. They're not going to say, "Ooh, I saw Metallica last night with no singer. It was awesome." You
know? Right. It's too bad that he couldn't come just for a little while, just to introduce people. Because if you think back also on some of the previous keynotes at WWDC, actually, I would say the last couple, he hasn't given the full keynote at all. I know introduction of Leopard may have been the first one where he came up and demoed some things, and then he passed it on to other people to introduce major features. Like Scott Forstall talked for a bunch about Time Machine, and I can't remember some of the other features, but I remember specifically he was a fraction of, you know, Steve Jobs was a fraction of the keynote, but it didn't matter. He got up on stage first, got a standing ovation, you know, everything was fine.
Yeah. Another thing that occurred to me is, this could just be a simple element of Steve Jobs's kind of stubborn desire to fulfill exactly what he said he was going to do. Mm-hmm. What did he say? He said something like, "I'm coming back to Apple at the end of June," something like that, right?
Yeah.
And coming back to WWDC earlier than that is perhaps something that the press and the fanboys would interpret as a positive thing. But I could see somebody like Steve Jobs saying, "I told you what I was going to do, and that's what I'm going to do."
Yeah.
You know, you're right. Not going to get any secret little sneaky peeky early bird special here. I'm coming back at the end of June. And then, you know, I could see it just being sort of a fulfillment of that control. You know, he has a reputation as a control oriented person. I'm holding out hope that actually it's just sort of like, this time is blocked out in Steve Jobs' mind and in his heart. And he will come back, and provided that his health is, you know, is good, he will go back to roughly the same old role. I have to imagine that Steve actually kind of enjoys being the lead singer, so to speak. You know, mm-hmm. Why would he give that up if it's something he does so well and he has been so successful at it over the past 10 years. It's possible he's burned out on it. He doesn't want to do it anymore. But it's kind of hard to imagine. This guy has been defined by his ability to persuade over the past, you know, 25 years, right? Mm-hmm. So why would he give that up? It doesn't really make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, he's so good at it. I mean, he's the best at doing that. And it would be kind of a shame. And I think he would also maybe feel like something was wrong if he didn't come back into a little bit of that role.
Yeah.
So I hope the same thing. I mean, hopefully the health isn't an issue and that you're right. It's just, I said, I'm coming back in late June. You know, I don't know what you guys are talking about. It's not late June yet. One positive thing that hopefully will come out of this is, please, no one camp out the night before. You know, Steve Jobs isn't there. I don't want to wake up at 5 a.m. to see the keynote. Hopefully it'll be a little more sane in terms of lining up and experiencing the keynote, not in the overflow room.
I wanted to address this question from Thomas Fors, which is, how can Mac developers implement a time-limited demo that can't be easily circumvented? What he's asking is probably pertinent, Manton, to the workflow you've been in lately. Before you release Clipstart 1.0, you build a beta release. It's obviously got bugs in it. It's got maybe even UI experiments, etc., that you're not sure you want to have live out for all eternity. So one of the common techniques that developers use is to sort of make a self-destructing application that after a certain number of days or months will no longer allow users to launch it anymore. Did you do anything like that for Clipstart?
So actually, I didn't. I've done that in the past, and I didn't do that for Clipstart. I'm not sure why I didn't. I guess I just didn't take the time to do it. It's easy to do, to put something in there where when you do a build, it automatically sets it to expire, you know, like 30 days after you do the build or whatever. I think for Clipstart, I had a really small beta group, and most of the people I knew
Yeah.
I knew they were going to stay up to date and they were not going to accidentally use the beta for 2 months. So I didn't really worry about it. But it's a good practice. And if you can get into your build cycle so you don't have to think about it, that's great. Just don't accidentally ship your 1.0 right. to Spires.
Yeah, I've sort of fallen out of doing it. I did it a lot with FlexTime when it was in a beta. And actually, I'll put a link in the show notes to a blog entry I wrote about this called Suicidal Code. But the basic gist of how you can do something like this is taking advantage of a compiler constant that is actually available to... It allows the code to compile in the actual date of the compilation. To sort of answer the technical question, how can this be done? It relies on a compile time burning into the code of what the present date is, and then once you have that in your code, you can obviously, you know, detect whether the current date that the user is running it, how that relates to that compiled in time. So that's the easiest way I know to do it with the current tools from Apple with GCC. Before I knew about that compiler trick, I was just putting in a hard-coded date. When I made the beta release, I'd say, okay, this is going to expire after, you know, June 6th or something. Mm-hmm. And right. But since I discovered this trick, it's kind of fun because you can set a, you know, set a compile time flag that says this app, whenever it's built, it should always expire 30 days later. One of the things then you have to be concerned with, of course, is leaving your customers with expired versions, and you neglected to get another update out before that expiration. As far as the part of the question that says can't be easily circumvented, I guess that's always sort of relative. Depending on who you're talking to, easily circumvented means a lot different things. To me, you know, the kind of check I'm talking about is pretty easily circumvented because I would just, you know, pop in with GDB and break on a line of code, step through until I saw the check and skip over it. But your average user isn't going to be able to do that. So it's sort of like the question of what's easy to circumvent with serial number registrations and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, you start with the basics and then it's up to you as a developer to decide how important it is to add obfuscation and trickery around that. I mean, one of the real obvious things you can do is similar to serial number obfuscation is to just sort of pepper your code with little checks that if you have like a macro or something that checks for this timeout, you can copy and paste that macro all over your code and it'll be kind of ugly and make your code a little bit harder to parse, maybe not too bad, but that's one of the tricks you can use to sort of make it at least more annoying for somebody who wanted to circumvent it. But I think in general for this type of thing, nobody really wants to run your old buggy right. beta version. So it's more of a courtesy. Yeah. It's more of like, actually, you know, Manton, I sort of interpreted this question in the way that I imagined myself using a time limited demo, but it's not clear from the, from at least the part of the question that we saved in our records here, whether Thomas was talking more about this beta testing approach or whether he literally wants to be able to give out like a demo mm-hmm. of a full product.
Right.
In which case, I guess it would be more of a serial number type of difficulty that you want to apply to it.
Yeah, I don't think he meant that, but I was wondering the same thing because that's kind of a different problem. Also, people can always change their date, but I don't think people do that anymore.
No,
because it just breaks so many things
yeah.
on your Mac.
You know what fixed that? Email fixed yeah. changing your date.
Yeah, it causes more problems then. So I wouldn't even worry about that problem.
Yeah.
People are going to be in for a world of hurt if they try to do that. So, but this is interesting, the idea of, for example, sometimes I would love to give someone a license code. And before I go there, actually, I want to take one step back and say, in my betas for ClipStart, I actually had serial numbers for all of them anyway. So I never had a beta that could be used without a serial number. I gave all my beta testers their own serial number. And that also, I think, minimizes the expiration problem, because if one was leaked out, you still need a serial number to use it.
Right.
But anyway, so this idea of having a serial number that in it, encoded in it, is the date that it expires. I don't have that. I would love to have it, though. It'd be nice if someone was running into a demo limit and they just wanted to really put the app through its paces for a week, if I could send them a serial number.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that?
No, I don't have that. That's kind of a cool idea, though. I agree. That's would be a useful extension of the serial scheme. But yeah, I think about adding that sometime. I think Omni Group does stuff like that with their Omni licensor.
There was another app that I ran across recently called QLab that I noticed another developer pointed this out, that he actually rents the app. I mean, you can buy the app, and it's a pro app. I think it's a couple $100. But he also has like a daily rental.
Yeah, I saw that. That is really interesting. And it seems like it works really well for his particular business model, because he's producing software for theatrical productions, where you can easily imagine a particular theater group having a fixed number of days or weeks that they actually need a budget, you know, to cover their tools.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's pretty cool. He charges, I think, $3 a day for the software for an unlimited number of machines. It's kind of a, you know, if you want to use it over the course of a summer, I guess, for your theater productions, then you can pay what, 3 times 90 days. Maybe,
yeah.
I don't know what the list price is. Maybe that adds up to be more than what it would cost for a license, but
I bet he knows his market really, really well.
Yeah.
And has judged that right. I mean, $3 a day at first seems really cheap, but I bet he's figured out that for the average production, if it's only going to be worthwhile if they only need it for a couple weeks, and if they need it more, they're better off buying, you know, a real license. Maybe even has like an upgrade. If I was doing it, I'd have some sort of upgrade deal. So if you've rented it for a while and then want to upgrade to the full version that doesn't expire, you know, you get some kind of discount.
Oh, and it's brilliant, because you get whatever money you get, that customer is still on the table as a future customer.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it's like, yeah. I would argue that a rental, if you can somehow come up with a way of working it into your sales scheme without it seeming totally contrived and weird, it's kind of perfect, because it's like somebody essentially paying to give your software an extended test. And, you know, they're more likely to be a person who refers the product to other people there. And they have had a substantial invested experience with using it, and they might buy it someday, or they might just rent it again next year or whatever. So I think that's really a cool idea and something to think about. I don't think it really applies to my products, because mine are sort of designed for long-term, you know, lifestyle change. But I'm curious about this. It's something that makes the gears turn.
And doing it as a rental is different than like a subscription model, where you're paying. I mean, it's similar, but it feels a little different than if you're paying like $30 a month to use a product, similar to how a lot of web applications are now. I've talked in the past on the show about how I use HiRISE from 37 Signals. And I recently looked, I've been using it for a couple of years. I recently looked at, like, I added up how much I paid for that. It's like several $100s that I paid to use the web app.
Yeah.
Where if I had just bought a Mac app to do the same thing, even if it was a, you know, quote unquote expensive Mac app for $50 or $100, it would have been way cheaper, right? And I could use it forever. And I think that's an advantage that downloadable, you know, traditional Mac apps have. But maybe there's some middle ground where you can have the best of both somehow, where for some people, a subscription model does work better. Maybe it's a service that requires a lot of data or you know, server-based interaction.
Yeah.
I mean, 37 Signals has turned their company into, you know, multi-million dollar business, because they have all these people that don't even use their apps every day. In some cases, every month, you know, the credit card gets charged. And from a business standpoint,
that's
pretty compelling. It'd be nice to...
Yeah, the recurring revenue stream is very... something that is easy to be envious of.
Yeah.
You know, I could imagine, you know, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking, like, for instance, I don't think I'm going to do this, but sometimes I get that crazy, 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 crazy feeling that many people get, which is, I'm going to write my own blog software. for the server, right?
Right.
And so, you know, there's already all these open source softwares out there like WordPress and Movable Type, and it's kind of silly, I think, to consider writing your own software. But let's, you know, if I just fantasize for a minute about the Red Sweater blogging system on the web, then that starts to open up this idea of a subscription service, because you could say, like, okay, Manton, I'm going to take care of everything. I'm going to give you your blog domain, your blog software, and Mars Edit for as long as you are hosting your blog on my little blog system, right? You know, overall, I don't know. There's something clunky about that, but it starts to get nice to imagine controlling the whole system, because it's kind of like how Apple controls the hardware and the software, right? They don't have to worry about being compatible with all these weird PC models. And that, unfortunately, I ended up in the situation where I'm trying to be like the Microsoft Windows of blog editors. You know, right. What have I done?
You're giving users a lot of flexibility, but it would be nice, yeah, if there was, you fire up the app and there's like a really smooth, you know, process if you want to use the hosted version. And Mars Edit, you know, could be free, like you said, yeah. Just pay the for the service.
It's an interesting thought. It's like, some ways it sounds so nice to be able to control. I'm at the whim of all these blog engines right now, but of course I'm at their whim, but I'm also benefiting greatly from all the work they're doing. So there's always a trade-off.
You wouldn't have to be the best or the most popular. That's the kind of nice thing if you decide to do something like this.
Yeah.
You could be kind of the default, and it would be a revenue stream. But people could still buy Mars Edit and use it with WordPress. And, you know, you're fine with that, right? Because that's what you've been doing.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. Interesting question. So my gears are definitely turning today. So I would call that a successful core intuition. Hopefully it gets the gears turning on some of our audience as well. And I think we're just about ready to wrap this up.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk to you next time.
All right. See ya.
Bye.